Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at alexlinder.com, eventually permanently archived. Today we're going to pick up with the middle part of James Mason's Siege, Chapter 7, Strength and Spirit. We're going to do 7.6 through 7.16. 7.6 begins. Hollow Vindication. A few years ago, it became quite inescapable to me that most of the conservatives at large who were of any note were voicing and printing stuff, the likes of which could have once been read in the early editions of the Rockwell Report. We even today have a president who voices many of the same things. In 1961, it was revolutionary. Today, it is all too little and too late. More and more, I'm struck by things which are getting into the daily headlines, the kind of things that 10 years ago you could only have found within the pages of the Thunderbolt. That was a white nationalist newspaper published for decades by Ed Fields out of Georgia, I believe. Not anything positive, but actual horror stories of the nightmares rampant in the street and the insanity abroad in the nation, directed primarily against whites. And think how insane, how it's a matter of degree. To him, things are crazy in the 80s from the early 60s. And to us hearing this, you know, 25, 30 years later, I mean, when there's almost daily acts of terrorism and mass shootings and the borders have been open, what he's saying sounds quaint, doesn't it? As I read to you in 2017. The sweet "we told you so" anticipated during the 1960s has been taken from us. It has arrived full force, and there still remains no answer for it, nor is there likely to be one. We warned of this then, and because of it we were, quote, lunatics, and in spite of it we are still lunatics, end quote, today. This at last should awaken and explain to the most hard-headed among us the true nature of the situation. We are witnessing the collapse of an entire civilization. Certainly not just what Rockwell called the, quote, American White Constitutional Republic, for which he fought, but the entire civilization of the world. The jungle is reclaiming, inexorably at present, and with only a slight slip of the wrist, could overtake very suddenly. Might have been a word missing there. It's happened before, maybe several times on Earth. But this, and certainly no other section of Siege, is intended as a crying towel. What is the larger meaning of all this to us, to the movement? The correlation between something spoken by Joseph Goebbels and a comment by U.S. Marine Corps General Holland Smith, both in 1945, provides part of the answer. Goebbels announced from the fiery ruins of Berlin that, should the National Socialist be compelled to depart the scene of world affairs, they would slam the door so hard on the way out that it would ring forever in the ears of those who remained. Holland Smith, as he oversaw the final retaking of the Pacific Islands, remarked to an aide whether there existed anything on earth that could defeat such men as those he was then leading. 40 years after the event, these two statements have come into balance. The thousand-year-old impetus of the world's civilization simply cut its own throat and bled to death. The surviving perpetrators and their miserable descendants are reaping the rewards of this. Precisely like an ancient curse, the very things Hitler warned against are today holding a knife to the throats of those who went to war to defeat Germany. And what are we except curious spectators? Are we not powerless to affect the situation in the slightest? We speak of vengeance, both individual and wholesale, yet we are powerless to act save under the most desperate conditions and in the most limited fashion. And the point being that so much time and energy is uselessly expended in this manner. What little we could accomplish, even by way of living our lives to the fullest, is relegated to a distant backseat in favor of feudal grandiosity in the face of a reality both somber and sober. Where he says both sober and somber. Eventually, everyone dies. What counts is the way they lived. I publicly professed a sense of having been cheated when it was learned that the system judge that had once sentenced me to a jail term for a racial political incident locally had died, quote, before his time. I did this to better express my everlasting contempt for all those who are part of the ruling pig system regime, both high and low, in this land, and also to illustrate my personal philosophy that the only real way to escape justice is to die either by natural causes or by one's own hand. But had I ever seriously entertained the possibility of our assuming the reins of an orderly government in an orderly manner and hauling such petty criminals and tyrants up before what used to be their own courts for final disposition? No, not down deep. However, the one important thing did occur to me at the time. I was alive, and that filthy bastard was dead. That's reality at work. In that one case, it worked in our favor. What we have got to do is become the masters of understanding reality, become experts at playing the game, and go a long way toward making reality work for us more often. Volume number 10, number 2. February 1982. That was 7.7 Measurements of Morality. Never wanting to appear self-contradictory, I'll bring it up myself that on occasion in Siege, I use the word morality. And I stick by my general pronouncement that morality, per se, as we have known it in years and generations past, is largely dead. At best, a bad joke for hypocrites and the self-righteous to hide behind, and something that certainly holds no use for any true revolutionary. Still, in our daily affairs, we each see things and encounter things we do not like that cause us to experience revulsion, things that none of us would do or involve ourselves in under any circumstances. What kinds of things are these? Why are we affronted by them? Why do we avoid them? And what do we do about them? Basically, we're talking about the prime moving stimuli that once propelled a fairly large and wealthy right wing to react against. Things that would drive the normal, healthy white right up against a wall. Hippies, dopesters, homosexuals, liberals, etc. Within the framework of the system, as these all fall under the heading of the new morality. But as James Montgomery Flagg commented on modern art, there is only true art or no art. Same goes for codes of conduct, for as Commander Rockwell wrote, the liberals' reasoning on the issue, i.e. everybody else is doing it, so why shouldn't I, is a nowhere argument and means there are no real morals at all. At a time when all central guideposts and authority are either broken down or under the control of the enemy, as is the case today, then such things as codes of behavior, more than ever, become matters of personal honor. Not the result of any alternatives conveniently presented by the system media. You neither do nor refrain from doing anything because it's easy or hard, or because everybody else isn't or is doing it. You instead follow your instinct. As revolutionaries, we have it easier than most in determining our own actions. There are those whom I consider to be National Socialist revolutionaries who do indulge in some of the more common vices normally ascribed to the general population. These are things which they take upon themselves with eyes wide open. I invariably refuse to judge such people because they remain, at that, revolutionary comrades, and, apparently, they don't let these things get a hold of them or affect their greater course. Personally, I'm the least moralistic of people, and am liable to try anything at least once. However, my circumstances keep me living about as clean, straight, and narrow as possible outside of a cloister. For me to indulge in the common vices, I'd have to abandon the movement just in order to find the time and the money. This, of course, isn't about to happen. I say hats off to those who can have their cake and eat it too. And I want to say, you should say, eat your cake and have it too. This isn't to say that the group of comrades aforementioned don't undergo their own privations. Barely staying even with last month's rent or the current meal serves well to, as one says, keep up the fear. In other words, keep up the awareness and feed the revolutionary flame. But when tackling the huge subject of morals, or lack of them, it is easier and better to pick on the masses which make up this society. Which could be the lowest, the Jewish systematarian or white capitalist traitor, or the hordes of don't-give-a-damn white fun-seekers and escapists? Somehow I can't find it in my heart to hate anyone with a direct purpose, however vile, nearly so much as an irresponsible shirker. Of course they work to pay the usurious cost of living, but, at that, only so as to be able to chase more fun. No higher purpose, no direction whatsoever. They literally have no legitimate excuse for living. Wouldn't it be hell one day, if one day, in order to go on living, an acceptable reason was required? In order to play more Donkey Kong? Have a nice forever. Degeneracy is degeneracy, whether morbid or, quote, recreational. Isn't there enough real work to do? Aren't there enough real battles, real challenges to fight and tackle? Fanatic that I am, I look upon such things as playing golf in the midst of a crisis like this, about the same way I do slamming a needle in one's arm. Let's look forward to the day we can hand out these golf and tennis players shiny new picks and shovels. These decadent slobs trying out every perversion on earth on the flimsy excuse of, quote, trying to find themselves, only really need a good chance to concentrate in order to find themselves. Maybe if we sent them to camp. Concentration camp. Penalties for such self-indulgence in the kind of society that breeds and fosters such filth? I, of course, am no law and order man, that is, alien law and alien order, and so the best possible reward for the desire of these modern-day cosmopolitan, quote, pleasures, is a limitless supply of same. What then when the thrill is gone, when the last substance is used up? In the years just preceding the revolution in Russia, that degenerate, burnt-out bourgeoisie came up with a novel answer to their boredom, Russian roulette, and it couldn't happen to a sweeter bunch. Again, life is simple to the fanatic. Commander Rockwell said that, quote, only failure is immoral. Direct quote, only failure is immoral. Anyone could expand that to mean that anything not contributory to the ultimate success of the revolution is immoral. You live, you breathe, you wake, you sleep for the movement, for revolution. You live as though an all-seeing eye is watching you and will one day pass judgment. And you make damn sure that you won't be counted among those others, not even by accident. That was volume 12, number 7, July 1983. 7.8. Well done, soldier. How can there be any talk of, quote, injustice when our sworn enemy holds all the power? What can you expect from a mortal enemy other than to try and wipe you out, anyway, at all? There is no middle ground, no one to go crying to. There is only ourselves and our enemy. Whether any particular minion of that enemy is conscious and energetic about his role, or whether he is merely going along with the current flow, or whether he simply chooses to turn away and let the chips fall. But one thing is certain. Nobody gives a damn about a crybaby anymore. Let there be no more talk about injustice. Let there only be talk of war. In the case of Gordon Kahl, K-A-H-L, militant white tax protester who engaged in a shootout with the federal marshals in which two of the pigs were killed and three wounded, Kahl was later killed in a second shootout, this man took a toll against the enemy. The only shame is that the toll couldn't have been much, much higher. With a relatively high degree of certainty, those of us who make up the high-profile segment of the movement today may expect to one day face our own similar such test. It is criminal and cowardly to hope to avoid it. It is best to be ready to perform admirably when the time comes. No lambs to the slaughter. If this isn't war, what is it? Before this is all over, most, if not all of us, will have faced, more than once, the ultimate reality of kill or be killed. For many of us, it will be kill and be killed, just as it was for Gordon Kahl. Only a coward and a shirker could expect less. There is no going back. Let us not cheapen the enmity we are locked into by crying injustice. Let us instead ready ourselves to withstand the worst that the enemy has to offer, and, at the same time, each swear a personal oath. Swift and unceremonious death to our opposition so that finis can be written to this life-death struggle for all time. That was Volume 12, Number 8, August 1983. Seven nine, Truth, Heritage, and Blood. Earlier in Siege, in the section concerning the system, chapter 5 that was, I spoke of the decline of architecture which I have observed over the decades here in Chillicothe, Ohio. Other expressions of culture, such as music, art, and literature, have gone the same way and in the same time span as architecture. For the rest, to try and establish a root cause and attempt to find an answer, we have to take in matters such as exactly what true values are and should be, how and why to remain a part of the whole, and not become, quote, atomized, as are the majority today, and of course the most important consideration of all, maintaining the purity of the blood. One can lament all day and all night with the, quote, historians over the loss of this or that prized old building, but the first instant one mentions why it is, what it is part of, and where it is leading, you rapidly lose them. That, of course, is one reason why I am a National Socialist and not merely a historian. Only this afternoon I had a discussion with a young schoolgirl, the daughter of a friend of mine, and I explained to her about the lost and even twisted meaning of a great many passages found in the Bible. The real meaning of, quote, adultery was one, and the real meaning of neighbor was another. I believe I made some headway. But I told her that the Bible was no more than a compilation of memories, long distant even at the time of their writing, whose actual basis and meaning had already been largely lost through countless generations of retelling, deletion, embellishment, etc. A thing so far removed from the one truth that inspired it that it is practically useless. A thing so vague, in fact, that, yeah, verily, yea, verily, even the devil can quote it toward his own ends. And you know I love to quote that from Shakespeare. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose. And that's why bandying Bible verses is a fool's game, a mug's game, an idiot's game, a Christian's game. And they're willing to go to war for it and over it, which is a measure of their own absurdity, not of any truth that they possess. I told her of other holy books older than the Bible and therefore nearer to the one truth, or, if you will, the Word of God, or, as I prefer, a more accurate account of what did happen back at the beginning of time, how we got here and what, if any, laws were at that time given. I left out any comment on books written in the previous and current century that are far more relevant and nearer the truth than is the Bible. The point being that things get lost. That's not to say they can't be refound or even reinvented, but that should never be taken as any kind of a breakthrough, but rather like learning to walk again after an accident or a stroke. If we can't remember or manage to hang on to where we came from and why, then is it any wonder that temporary things like civilizations come and go like sandcastles? In the United States today, it is rare when a white person is able to trace his lineage back beyond great-grandparents. For most, that barely clears the turn of the last century. In human terms, that is practically within living memory. What culture, then, is this? Members of the movement understand how so much has been lost by our people over the last 60 years. True, it has been no accident, but it is just as real and just as effective nonetheless. And how close is the present culture to being erased? They say it can't happen because of microfilm and videotape, etc. But what if the power goes out and stays out? Our books? Illiteracy is on the rise, and the ongoing corruption of the English language through, quote, jive talk, they didn't have Ebonics quite yet, I guess, etc., threatens to get it so off-base that a separate tongue will emerge altogether. The ancient Egyptian language, a creation of the white race, was completely lost and unintelligible for thousands of years, even in Egypt, until Napoleon's expedition to the pyramids uncovered the Rosetta Stone, which provided the key to its translation. But it can't happen here. Famous last words. A few hundred years gone by, and no one here today sees or thinks of America as being no more, no less than an extension of Europe. To them, Europe is some funny place over there where they speak funny languages. Civil war, world war, fratricidal war. There is little doubt that this present civilization, in its degenerated, bastardized state, will self-destruct and vanish, as well it should, and quite likely within the present human lifespan. What will go on? Let us hope that the end of this beast system, which can only facetiously be referred to as a civilization, will be concluded before its effects can totally inundate the pure white blood that still exists in great amounts in North America, Europe, and the Soviet Union. Then the cycle can be set to go around another 10,000 years or so. And that was Volume 12, Number 10, October 1983. 7.10. Honor, Loyalty, Discipline. To a National Socialist, the definitions of these words are just about impossible to separate. In any case, this was the motto of the National Socialist Youth Movement, of which I was a member from 1966 to 1970, and was printed boldly across the top of the NSYM membership cards. I always carried my own cards, one for each of the 4 years I was part of the NSYM, proudly on my person at all times, and would often take the current one out of my wallet and look at its beautiful design and ponder those words. As a youth in contemporary America of the 1960s, the words were familiar enough from literature, etc., but their real meaning was something I was only just then starting to learn on my own. There was the local ration of kooks and hangers-on, which I had but little choice other than to pal around with, but I wasn't long in realizing that I was the only National Socialist within a 100-mile radius. It got lonely at times. These words, honor, loyalty, discipline, came into sharp focus for the first time for me during one of my earlier confrontations with the system, this time represented by the local school administration. A new semester had just begun, and I was at a new building with a new and reputedly tougher faculty. They were aware of my record as an incorrigible and knew my stated aim was to break free of the school system once and for all. They were determined to prevent me. On the first day of the new season, after I had staged my anticipated opening play and now found myself seated in the office of the assistant principal, awaiting whatever their next move might be, one of the school's three, quote, guidance counselors, unquote, abruptly whisked into the small room with an obviously rehearsed spiel of threats to the effect, "Okay, boy, you're going to court." With that psychological icebreaker out of the way and seeing me nonplussed, he sat down and started to try and reason. Finally, he got around to the stories which were rife that I was a Nazi. Yes, indeed, I was. Thinking it must surely be some kind of a put-on, he asked whether I had any identification to that effect, whereupon I wasted no time in producing my NSYM card. He was silently impressed and just gazed down at it for a moment before speaking. The only thing he could come up with was that it said on the card something about discipline. And did I think that I was now behaving in a disciplined manner? And for the first time ever, I was forced to see the deep division. Well, I'm sorry, the words were jammed together there. For the first time ever, I was forced to see the deep division between loyalties and that code of discipline that my honor was demanding of me. My answer to that obviously loaded trick question on the part of this poor man's Justice Jackson, Nuremberg Justice, was that since I owed this system no loyalty or respect whatsoever, and since I openly considered it to be my personal enemy, my discipline was being directed toward opposing it and trying to break away from it in any manner available to me, including risking possible legal repercussions from it. He handed me back my card. I never did go into juvenile court, and within less than 90 days I was indeed out of there, once and for all, and in full service of the movement, where my discipline could be put to better use. This, quote, counselor whom troubled students, mere youths in their formative stages, were supposed to go to for help and advice, failed to grasp the larger meaning of my answer, and next posed the second question. What did I think would have happened to anyone acting as I was in Germany under Hitler? He could not see that my antisocial behavior there and then was not for the hell of it, nor was it even part of my nature, but rather an irresistible course of action forced upon me by an absolutely intolerable situation that was, and still is, referred to as, quote, universal compulsory liberal education, unquote. I was rebelling against the so-called education system, which was only at that time beginning to crank out endless hordes of illiterates with high school diplomas, become factories for race mixing, of introductions to dope use, liberal ideas, and worse. No, in Hitler's Germany, I'd have diligently applied myself like a tiger. This only just means that honor, loyalty, discipline has no meaning whatsoever in this place, at this time, and among these people. Not even among the learned conservative World War II veterans that were the older generation when I was a kid. In simple terms, they can't see beyond the ends of their noses, nor to the right or left of the blinders they are wearing. I came up against this early in life. Maybe that has colored my view of people and things to a more marked degree than most others, even inside the movement. Two lessons taught to me at that time were, one, doing what you have to do as you see it, and two, arriving at the end conclusion of a certain principle in the most direct fashion in the shortest possible time. Morally, I left that 40-odd-year-old man who had to at least have had a bachelor's degree in the dust as a Hitler youth at the age of 16. And, as anyone from that period will be aware, revolutionary training in those days of the American Nazi Party was pretty skimpy. Can you imagine what can happen when we start to do it right? And that was Volume 12, Number 10, October 1983. 7.11. Poor but honest. We're down and out for a very simple reason. We have no place in what's going on. That's also why we're revolutionaries. The only sad and silly part comes in when those in that position fail to appreciate or understand it. That's true miserability. Not really a word, but you get his point. We've always worked without the basic necessities, even food. But in a better organized situation, we had each other to depend on. You must be prepared to go it strictly alone, with no one to depend on and no one to complain to. You'll discover that to really be outside and against the system is a total thing, not halfway or part-time as many have pretended in the past. Anyone thinking they can step outside master's rules only to the extent that master doesn't notice or object is self-deceiving and worthless to the cause. We've seen literally armies of these types come and go. It may be hard, it may well be impossible, for most to go through what has been gone through, especially in the midst of more or less normal times, when, as an infant might remark, quote, you don't have to, in order to be truly part of the movement. But, for those who are able, even in these times, there are certain rewards. You'll become physically and mentally tough. You'll lose any fear. Minus any fanfare or uniform of any kind, even with your commitment, a complete secret, you'll stand apart and inspire wonder and respect. You'll in fact be a leader. You'll become resourceful and can make do with nothing. No situation, no opponent will daunt you. You will no longer be victim material. You will cease to be part of the herd of sheep, but will instead have become a lone wolf. Your inner spirit will feel satisfied because you know that you are, probably for the first time in your life, fully a part of the quest for actual survival rather than for temporary pleasure and false security. You'll be rich in your manhood or womanhood. You won't be a slave. Let there be no complaint lodged against those trashy ones who turn their backs on struggle and refuse to support the cause. Do we desire to make ourselves dependent upon their pleasure and their whim? Let there be no room for doubt in the coming disaster, regardless of what form it may take or what timetable it may keep. That, as we have said, will be the day of judgment and, for the most part, it will be entirely beyond our power to affect others' fate, either by our praise or condemnation. It will go according to how they have lived. Harsh circumstances and not a vengeful God will be the judge. Amidst the sudden hell and chaos, what will the sloppy and lazy ones do? For ourselves, we'll hardly notice any change, for we'll feel right at home. Volume 12, number 12, December 1983, that was. 7.12. On your own. It's not on our own, but on your own. After all, how much help can I expect from you, and how much can you expect from me? Quadruple this in times of great stress, again, before the internet. Let's face it, we are islands for the most part, and the quicker we face up to the fact, the sooner we'll be able to deal effectively and intelligently with it. I've seen it too often in the years past, whenever someone got their tail in a jam. Those in positions to get the word out may certainly do so, but never have I seen support, in the amount needed, come in to affect the situation one way or another. That's reason number one why I had never have bothered to make appeals on behalf of myself or my operation. When a comrade requested me that I print an appeal for him, and if it is a bona fide good cause, I'll do it as a favor, but I always caution them in advance never to bank on any results. If we are to call ourselves a movement with any degree of seriousness, then the kind of shabbiness I've laid out above is plain suicide. Flirting with ultimate, eventual disaster. I've always wondered when the enemy would finally read the signals given out by the movement over the decades, which indicate that it can be knocked over one by one with perfect ease, except for the singular exceptions who fight back, like Gordon Call and a precious few others, and take logical, dreaded action upon the situation. You've been asking for it. Sooner or later, they'll give it to you. None of my material is ever intended as a spook story or a down trip, per se. I write about this because I take a certain personal sense of pride, along with others, in having stood literally alone against the beast system. I don't consider this an end goal, far from it, but if I should die tonight, I will have accounted for a hell of a lot more than most others. It has its elements of satisfaction. Again, that's not enough. It is better viewed as a good preparatory phase in the development of revolutionaries. Anybody can stand in a mob or with an army. Few can stand alone. These are the only kind we want. When I was newer at this, I would stand in amazement at the sight of ex-members of the armed forces, combat veterans in many instances, who would be quivering and quaking and whispering their intentions of imminently running during confrontations with the real enemy, the enemy at home. How did we ever win any wars? One answer is massive logistics. The other answer would apply to all peoples, everywhere, in any army you care to discuss. The ordinary soldier at the front knows in his heart of hearts that his government, hence his people, is behind him for better or worse while he is out there risking his life. He knows he'll come in for all kinds of benefits, etc., once he gets home. If he is injured in the line of duty, he knows he's in for even more benefits and the best medical care on earth. He knows also that if he screws up, he's in for hell, supplied by the same overwhelmingly huge machine he's working for. And, as Hitler pointed out in Mein Kampf, the average soldier in the world is more afraid of his own commanding officer than he is of the enemy. In short, he is not alone, and he knows it. Take the same soldier who performs honorably on the field of battle, such as Korea or Vietnam, and put him with a handful of fanatics in a Nazi uniform on some demonstration or picket line at home. Forget about the Negroes and Jews, but let the local white yokels come out in to hoot their ignorant, idiotic brand of patriotism and watch what happens. He falls apart. He tucks his tail between his legs. He's on his own. He's alone. We half-joked during the 60s as we'd be approaching one or another Red Nest, quote, college or university, preparing for a Bomb Hanoi demonstration or literature distribution at the height of Vietnam that, even though we may have numbered only 4 to 6 men, as opposed to a numberless red rabble on the campus, it would require them at least a good hour to get a mob worked up before they would attack. Most of the time, we were right, although not always. Even among the scum, there were a few leader types, some real zealots. Otherwise, the mob had to rely on weight of numbers and the anonymity and backup that it provided before attempting to rush us. It's just like today with the so-called Antifa. Anti-whites. We tried to utilize to best advantage the maxim that nobody wants to be the first one to get it. It sort of helped neutralize their numbers game. Somebody had to be the first in. Also, half-jokingly, we figured that one could only be attacked by a maximum of 7 persons at once, the rest having to wait their turn before they could get in a punch. Surprisingly few were willing to be among the first. In later years, when I'd be in charge of security of an operation, I'd deliberately set things up to where, if an enemy mob tried to attack, they'd have to do so down a narrow corridor or gauntlet, practically single file. Spoken, but unwritten, orders were to kill the first 3 or 4 and thereafter worry about saving your own life. This strategy never let me down on any occasion. We never seemed to run up against any scum that sincerely sought martyrdom for their scumbag cause. Being a martyr, or dying as one, really requires being A-L-O-N-E. Human types are a breed of animal that are social as hell. I've personally witnessed many a self-styled, quote, rough ass, maximum security prison guards, etc., who could regale you with endless hairy stories from inside the block, etc., sit and literally cry in their beer because some woman was threatening to divorce them and take all their property, plus a large chunk of their income. In the block, you have the flying squads. In divorce court, you're alone, which brings things around to their greatest source of fear, being caught alone, loss of security. But security, even in a military sense, is a relative thing at best. Taken in any other sense, it becomes an illusion. They talk about, quote, job security, quote, family security, quote, home security, social security, etc. The way to terrorize and control these people is through control of the money system. And this is exactly what we see today. Big burly men will cry and crawl, beg and plead, even blow their brains out with enough of an applied financial squeeze play. It's a miserable and disgusting sight. I can't feel any pity toward them because it is they who chose to accept the rules of the game from the system. It is they, at the same time, who curse me and my kind as no goods because we don't punch a time clock or otherwise make slaves of ourselves. The other thing which prevents most people from being willing to stand alone is that they don't have any reason to do so. None whatsoever. These are, of course, the masses, and I don't condemn them for anything except when they break bad with me for not only having a cause, but also for my standing up for it. They live only to produce and consume, to masticate and defecate. Wasted exercises in protoplasm. Here only to breathe the air and take up space. Not really valid reason for living, or no really valid reason for living. Show them a real cause and a real act, and they'll hate it and resent it, because it makes apparent the bottomless futility and insignificance of their own lives. The furthest cause or belief they know or will accept or will admit is today's washed-out, washed-up, homogenized, and mass Christianity. Being on your own, strictly speaking, has its disadvantages, but these are the kind of disadvantages referred to by Hitler and Nietzsche as being the makers of superior, truly great men. Personally, I don't know of anything, however small or insignificant, on a daily basis, that isn't some kind of struggle. And mostly these days, it is financial. So be it. I've often said, often enough said, that economics is the key. Not those that have it, but those that can live without it. I've already experienced the rest. We need and want professional revolutionaries, men who are truly tough, inwardly, where it counts, men who will not flinch at anything that they themselves have to endure, much less anything which they may inflict upon the enemy one day. We need a large band of those, quote, flint-hard personalities, the kind of which, though they may have been of alien blood and creed, took over Russia when the roof came crashing down around the ears of a rotten and decadent ruling class, one so very similar to that which exists here today. We each tread that course alone, as must be. We each either arrive at our destination in full figure, or will have perished along the way due to some weakness. Alone. Volume 13, Number 1, January 1984. 7.13, Beliefs and Ideas. Back again to ourselves as proof that it can happen, that an oasis of thought and purpose can arise in the midst of a barren desert. To be sure, no propagandist injected any of the philosophy we share into our heads. It was there all along. It was there at birth. It required only development, enhancement, maturity. We are not the brainwashed ones, as the fools and idiots claim. We are the few that rejected the total brainwash job being put forth by the system media. The same job that has been going on nonstop 24 hours a day for the past 40 years or longer, under which three generations have been warped and bent. To have stood immune to this poison, deliberately made inescapable, is something truly miraculous. But we few did it, and went on to codify our own beliefs independent of the media hype and all its diversion. We should congratulate ourselves for this remarkable feat. We are familiar with the concept of the mass taste, as dictated by New York and from Hollywood, the, quote, styles and fads, etc., the, quote, two sides to everything that are conveniently supplied by the same source, the catchwords and phrases and personages that are sanctified or damned by the media masters. We can see that, despite all the hell and unrest, nothing is ever really said or done to significantly rock the boat by any of these so-called, quote, protests. Though many words are used, nothing profound is ever said. We already know of the idle gripe and the idle platitude. The point is that probably only 1 out of 10,000 has an idea in his head not planted there by some outside source. Those unable to think independently on their own have no chance of doing anything else. Volume 13, Number 3, March 1984. Seven 1.14 performance. We're on page 351 at the bottom. We have all seen the phenomena which tend to spell out that there is no longer any dependability, that no one's word anymore is worth a damn. They'll agree with you, they'll tell you they'll do it, they'll be there or they'll have it, and they'll look you right in the eye, maybe even give you a dish rag handshake. Come the appointed hour and place, zero. Excuses will be as imaginative as they will be aplenty. It is only par for the course nowadays. Lots of talk and no action. Spinelessness. The logjam in the courts and the proliferating oversupply of lawyers in the country says the rest. George Lincoln Rockwell advocated the return to dueling in order to wipe out this mess and restore honor and value to man's word. Compare things today with Hitler's remarks at the Sixth Party Congress in Nuremberg when he said that the legions of faithful present had been summoned only by the command of their hearts. Strange that these other types can only be made to perform regularly and with some dependability through the knowledge that doing otherwise will lose them their livelihood. Job slaves, money terror. How many on-the-job hotshots with padded billfolds, cushy positions, and all the rest have each of us encountered who cannot or will not perform dependably for the movement, i.e. on their own, for themselves, for their race? That is the true measure. It means that anyone can be paid and prodded into some service or routine, but to perform faithfully and well in the service of one's inner calling, assuming one has one, despite any hardship, is rare indeed. That's Volume 13, Number 3, March 1984. 7.15, Discipline. Taken along with all the rest, it would be difficult to try and tag any one symptom as the major one with regard to the entanglement the American people finds itself in as to regaining control over their lives and their future. But I would have to offer lack of discipline as certainly among the foremost. Of course, when a society has lost its normal health and vigor and no longer cultivates true discipline upon its citizens, then it has to come from within. Self-discipline. This is also the key element that has ever been lacking in the building of a successful political movement in this country. This is the cement among the sand, gravel, and water, without which all the rest is but soup. Among movement members and organizations, it manifests itself in those not holding a steady course or pursuing effective long-range goals. It prepares the way for the endless mutinies, splinters, and factions, the you-can-go-to-hell attitude which prevails. When the only discipline that can be exercised from inside these organizations is mere expulsion from same, then the cycle is foredoomed to be repeated out into infinity. Only self-discipline can correct the mess. And again, approximately 1 in 10,000 possesses the capability to muster it from within and bring it to bear. Among the remainder, it shows itself as Uncle Tomism. Conforming and staying in line doesn't require discipline. It instead takes a lack of initiative and vision. The biggest, the baddest, the roughest, and the toughest. All will never step out of line, not really. A bar fight and a weekend in jail for drunken disorderly hardly constitutes a revolutionary act. They cannot and they will not conceive of taking a revolutionary departure from what Big Brother expects of them. Beyond that, it is most often seen in the population as everyone informing on everyone else. Isn't this the scenario they painted for Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia? What's so different here? Maybe it's in a good cause. Every man and Uncle Tom, pinch the pusher, in quotes, quote, take a bite out of crime, etc. And what constitutes a criminal? Hotlines and toll-free numbers. Whisperers and dime droppers everywhere. Infiltrators, spies, finks, snitches, pimps, both on the official payroll and off. Keeping safe by ratting out to Big Brother, it's the national pastime. No honor, no discipline, no guts. Look at Ireland, where white is pitted against white over idiotic issues such as religion and geography. They are tar and feathering Irish girls who date British soldiers. They are bombing British installations and killing people in high places regularly, and no one breathes a word about it. A Negro and a white renegade parade down Main Street here, and what occurs? Usually nothing. And if something did occur, a hue and cry such as has not been seen for any rape or murder. Not only would the populace not offer any aid to the revolutionists, they'd be all out helping the pigs run them into the ground. I'm not about to say that this can be overcome. It simply is a fact of life and something that we will have to learn to recognize and work around. To me, it represents the sign of the very lowest of low, the mark of a people who no longer hold any claim to freedom or liberty. In short, people who are fit only as slaves. Volume 13, number 3, March 1984. 7.16. Intellect, instinct, and personal loyalty. Intellect, instinct, and personal loyalty. This is about how real leadership works. Not good administration, but real leadership. Since last year, I've had an acquaintance, a young lady whose company I enjoy very much, but who, unfortunately, is a hopeless liberal. You may first ask why in the hell I waste my time with her, and I would respond that, one, the mere fact that she continues the relationship indicates she has a spark of life left somewhere, and two, it is the best way to learn the workings of the human heart and mind. Besides, it's entertaining and it breaks the boredom. First, she's top-notch racially, being primarily Germanic. Second, she's a brilliant conversationalist, which is damned rare in this one-mule town in Chillicothe, Ohio. She's one of the system's primary victims, yet, at the same time, one of the system's most outspoken advocates. I was also told by another comrade that we happen to be totally opposed astrologically, if that means anything. Anytime the conversation turns to politics, she ends up screaming, stomping out of the room, slamming doors, etc., etc. Later, she'll say how it upsets her to allow herself to become so frustrated while I never ruffle a feather at all her name-calling once her, quote, facts and arguments all draw blanks, and I start walking all over taboos and superstitions popularly held sacred today. According to her, and to her kind, of course, I'm the problem. Poisoning, subverting, befouling the workings of the great democracy. There's something wrong with me. That's why things are so irrevocably, inexplicably screwed up in the country and the world. True liberal logic. Jews in the system know how to play these people like a violin. Commander Rockwell said that it was because of the high level of development of the abstract virtues or advanced instincts of charity, decency, and fair play found exclusively among the best racial types within the white race. The Jews have done an almost complete job of perverting these instincts into the Negro-worshipping mania that is everywhere today. But it's tough to feel sorrow, much less kinship, for anyone who will sneer at you and say that they have an intelligence quotient of 140 And therefore, they know it all, and furthermore, any Negro that comes along with an equally high IQ is just as good as you or I, maybe even better. To seemingly further illustrate her argument, I never make any bones about the fact that I left school at the age of 16 and made my way to party headquarters. She, of course, has had several years of college. Still, she can't nail me in facts and principles. And only after I thoroughly debunked her to the merit of so-called IQ, in my own terms, according to my own values, did I tell her that when last tested by the public schools at the age of 14, my IQ far exceeded hers when last tested as an adult. My argument against pure intellect, or IQ, or the placing of too much emphasis on its importance, is simply that it is but one physical attribute, or blessing, if you will, to be used by the possessor. And it can be used for good or evil. Most of the slimy bastard lawyer politicians ruling this land today have exceptionally high IQs. It only enables them to tighten and maintain their ruthless and destructive hold over the rest of us. A really high IQ can be compared to weighing 500 pounds or having three arms or four legs. Depending on the circumstances, it can be a blessing or a curse. Jews, of course, as a group, are known for their power of intellect. So what does this prove? That intellect is only a tool to be used, or a weapon to be wielded. Used or wielded by what higher power? Nobody ever heard tell of a, quote, noble intellect. Intellect doesn't move people. If anything, it serves to hold them back from bold and daring action. A stone coward, by use of his intellect, can come up with 1,000 perfectly plausible covers for his cowardice. The same swine that hold political office today use intellect to swamp the simple people in massive confusion and colors of gray. The lone intelligent individual, many of whom are to be found in the right, may have sat down and sorted it all out for themselves, but to what avail? Because again, intellect cannot mobilize the masses. People are largely unthinking. Of what benefit was intellect to any guy out to seduce some female? Hitler himself told us that the masses are feminine in nature. Of what good is intellect to its owner in the instant that sudden violence occurs? Instinct, a healthy instinct, stands second only to pure blood in vital importance. Hitler in Mein Kampf said that loyalty took precedence over intelligence, and loyalty is but one byproduct of instinct. Aside from pure blood, nobility is found in the instinct. Facts can be distorted, but the sixth sense, where it exists strong and unsullied, is well nigh impossible to deceive. Instinct is the product of eons of evolution. So-called intellect is measured by the amount of information one can store in one's head, whether that information be essential or rubbish. That's actually wrong, because IQ is a measure of capacity, not of learning. When it comes down to male-female relations, it's a matter of what animal signals. And what I mean by that is something that is just about as good as any IQ test ever devised is how quickly you have a range of lights in front of you and buttons before each of those lights, and the tester lights up one of the, say, five lights, and a very good proxy is how quickly you can press the button under the light he just lit. It's almost as good as any test, and that proves it's a brightness or it's a capacity. It's not what you've learned. That's something separate. When it comes to male-female relations, it's a matter of what animal signals are sent out and how well the other party senses these. In combat, animal one-on-one combat, instinct takes over completely and the intellect shuts down so as not to impede the organism in successfully fighting to preserve its existence. Only man in his ignorance, pride, and conceit, his off-base worldview with himself as the center of the universe and above natural law, has made possible the awful mess people are living in today. But did you ever notice how people with healthy instincts rarely need to be propagandized or otherwise, quote, straightened out? Those who require propagandizing can only at best hope to make up a class of distant followers, never leaders. Leaders in the leadership cadre itself, must be able to serve as their own guiding light and their own inspiration. They cannot be skaters who need to lean on anyone else or be carried when times are tough. Nobody ever told me it might be like this. Total instinctive awareness is far superior to any number of years in a university. Can instinct be cultivated, and can it be dulled? I rather think so, and I am certain the Jews think so too, which is the reason for such things as Project Head Start and the general program of school busing, to kill off the instinct before it has a chance to grow. To what extent the artificially created drug plague plays a role in this can only be estimated, but I feel it must be devastating. Regardless of the degree of any success the Jews in the system may have had or shall have in the future in making the walking dead out of otherwise healthy, happy human beings, the number that somehow manages to hold on, through some fortuitous genetic twist, and resist the poison, will respond to the call when it comes from the right leader. The rest, as we can clearly see already today, are of no use anyway. But what I refer to as the proper leader or the proper lead is just that. It is not one more poor man's sneaky attempt at a clever charade or club activity. Far less is it an exercise in counterculture revisionist thinking. It is a call to action. It will be a call for millions of people to lay down their lives. It had better ring true. Most of all, it is a call to action by those currently acting on their own. I've said in the past that when it really starts to happen, it will happen fast. Right at the moment, nothing is happening. Nothing except our enduring this most tiresome, agonizing, and potentially discouraging phase of the struggle when nerves and spirits are tested to the utmost. The instinct for action cannot be fooled. It will not respond to a false alarm. Nothing half-hearted will strike fire. I've seen many small sparks made. I've seen the pattern of how it works. When the current is running through you, and only then, it can be transmitted to others, and the process of making an army has started. I did it myself again last month, and worked a last-minute miracle in court. Of the small army I contacted the night before, not a single one failed me. Some got out of sick beds. Others left their jobs in order to be in court at 8:30 a.m. to be there for that purpose, a real purpose, not bullshit. That sort of thing can only happen fast. Dragging it out will kill it surer than any action by the enemy. And what has the right wing been known for these umpteen decades other than dragging it the hell out? People get tired. I am tired. But I also happen to be one of the tiny few whose guts are permanently on fire. Most people don't have the capacity or the desire for that. Massive-scale, high-performance output can only be maintained for short periods. A successful revolutionary will know how to get it, how to direct it, and how to secure rapid results before it dies down. Look at the 1905 aborted revolution in Russia, or the Munich Putsch, or the so-called revolution of the 60s. Other than members of the hardcore, the rest will respond only to a visible, known, and familiar leader figure. And down through the ranks, that pattern will follow. Personal loyalty has historically been what the hinge of fate has turned on. Owing to the split-second dynamics, historically speaking, of great revolutionary movements, this is well and good. Lenin lived the bulk of his 50-odd years in comparative obscurity as an exile. But he was the man in time for the Russian Revolution, and afterwards only lived a scant 6 more years. Hitler knew that as leader of the world's most crucial revolution, he had to move fast lest he die and his revolution flounder without him. Quote, "He spoke with the eloquence of emergency," unquote. And the current which ran strong through him was conveyed to all of Germany. So Hitler spoke with the eloquence of emergency, and the current that ran through him was conveyed to all of Germany. Those who are already committed to the struggle, whether win or lose, these are the ones who need propagandizing and politicking so as to hone themselves up to maximum ability. If we try that on people who are already waiting for the leader to appear so that they may follow him, we will alienate and lose them. They don't want to hear it. Hell, I don't want to hear it. If anything, the instinct is the only, quote, soul any of us will ever know. The only God any of us has exists in our bloodstream. Let us hope that the God within will provide our souls the answer to the dilemma we face and give us the strength to lead our people. When we begin to lead naturally, then 100 years of brainwash and distortion will be smashed in an instant. That was Volume 12, Number 9, September 1983. And we'll leave it there for now, and then we'll come back later and get the rest of Chapter 7, Strength and Spirit, I think it was called. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.